Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. We are very sorry we missed you last week. We were caught in a short week with a Thursday game. I actually took the podcast equipment through TSA security, and we just didn't have time to use it on the road, unfortunately. But we're back. We missed you. We're here.
We missed, yes, I missed you all too. I missed you, Ben, even though I missed you in this format. I saw you around the office quite a bit, obviously.
What they call, I call just not recorded podcasts or conversations.
Yes.
We have those.
Maybe we should stick microphones at everybody's desk and record everything. Of course, all that would make everyone paranoid.
Yeah.
And A, and B, for those who aren't paranoid, I would be like, okay, don't use that. Don't use that. Don't use that. Many of my bon mots are not fit for public consumption.
Phil would be like the Dwight in The Office. He would be the star. He'd just get mad all the time.
Yes. If Phil is not complaining about
like
something,
his on-air personality.
Yeah, if Phil's not complaining about something, he's not in his natural element.
Something's
people,
not right. Yeah, if Phil's not yelling.
If he's happy, I'd be like, what happened here? Where did Phil go?
It must be the off season.
Yes.
I guess we kind of were talking about this off air, and I think it'd be a good place to start. We'll save our game preview for a little bit later, but starting off, I'd like to talk about the Steelers and their propensity to go for two so far, which is a bold maneuver, as you were saying, and maybe a brave one. This week is definitely one that doesn't exactly take a lot of chances, but I think that goes for sports in general when you have so much on the line. I think safety is something that a lot of teams are okay with doing.
Yeah, it's a risk-averse culture for the most part, but Pittsburgh, the way that the Steelers have run their organization over the years, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it was, you know, go back to even when Bill Cowher was coaching the team, and they had a reputation for, you know, having a grinded out offense. But the Steelers ran more gadget plays when Cowher was coaching back in the day than anybody else in the league. They were the ones that figured out how to use, you know, Cordell Stewart. Remember when they called him Slash? Mm-hmm. You know, they made use of the multifaceted talents of Antoine Randle L. And in terms of how they manage their operations relative to the salary cap, they were one of the first teams that understood that you've got to have a price point and on players, and if the player wants more than that, you've got to bite your lip and you got to let him go rather than overspend. And it's, you know, that's part of the reason why the Steelers have been a perennial contender, you know, over the decades. They're a smart organization. So it doesn't surprise me that they are at the vanguard of embracing the two-point conversion, going for two early against the San Francisco 49ers. You know, we've written about this on DenverBroncos.com that, you know, if you went for one from 33 yards on the new length of the PAT, or if you went for two every time, if you were league average, over time you would do better and get a few more points over the course of a season going for two. Now, obviously, there's different situations to consider with each with each touchdown, but when you're talking about early in the game, and Oregon's done this for years, going for two after the first touchdown early in the game, what's the harm in going for two, really? Because the game situation has not begun to really bear itself out. So kudos to Pittsburgh for doing this.
ESPN actually looked at, through 2 weeks, the success rate of extra points and two-point conversions from this year going back to last year. Last year, extra points, they were 139 for 140.
So. Already more misses on PATs this year than in the entirety of the 2014 season.
And last year they had, or this year, there are 9 misses. So 146 for 154. That's a 99% rate versus 94% rate. And two-point conversions are up. It looks like 17 percentage points, so from 36% to 53%. Small sample size, of course, but a very interesting trend, I think, we're looking at here. And the Steelers, I think, you said the fortune favors the bold, and we kind of talked about how this I had seen on a tweet that the trend of going for two is kind of similar to in the NBA or in basketball in general, the trend of going for threes a lot more often is similar. And kind of made me think back to the team that was really on the forefront of that as far as modern popularity is the Phoenix Suns. And obviously they did not reach their goal of getting a championship, but the success of that kind of trend may have been seen obviously this past year with the Warriors lighting teams up, or going even further back to the small ball Miami Heat of the past few years.
Well, and even to go farther back than that, when Rick Pitino was coaching in college in the 1980s, he was one of the first coaches that figured out the power of what was then the 19-foot, 9-inch three-point line in college basketball, which I think we can all agree is ridiculously short. And he was coaching Providence, and it was the Providence job that he would parlay into the Knick job, and then he played that into the Kentucky job.
He did the same with the Knicks as far as the three-pointers.
Yes.
They had some success there.
Back in the late 80s.
If you thought people were skeptical of the three-point kind of trend, you know, in the past decade.
Oh, in the 80s.
The New York Daily News, I think I saw an article, they were not buying into it.
They weren't buying into it, but by the time you got to the 90s, teams would at least have kind of a designated shooter.
Right.
You know, I some of that was the Knicks. Some of that, you remember Vinnie Johnson?
Yeah,
microwave, because he heated up. He was come off the bench and he could give you a couple of threes. Craig Hodges, the perpetual winner of the three-point contest, was a key cog in the Chicago Bulls coming off the bench for some quick offense. But what I remember about Pitino when he first started espousing the three-point gospel was he would tell his teams, and I remember he'd tell them his first years at Kentucky, he didn't want any shots from 10 to 19 feet 5 inches. He wanted everything inside of 10 feet or beyond the arc, because he didn't think the value was that the potential value was there in the mid-range jump shot, because it was only good for 2 points. So just stretch it out, get outside, and shoot the three. And now, you know, that's look at the NBA of today, and look how teams, you know, try to stretch it out, and you know, that you still see some mid-range jumpers, but most teams realize unless you're wide open, the value isn't necessarily going to be there.
Oh. One second, I am going to decline this phone call. So I think in my kind of illusion between the Steelers now and the Suns back then, or going back to Pitino's Knicks or anything like that, I feel like even if the Steelers don't succeed this year, you know, even if they don't go to the conference championship, or they don't go to the Super Bowl, or they don't win the Super Bowl, people might try and use that to kind of bury them or bury the trend of going for two.
Yeah, which is insane. What you want to examine is how many more points over the course of the year the Steelers get by going for two on a frequent basis than by going for one. So what value did they add? If they don't go to the conference championship, doesn't mean that the tactic was a failure by any stretch, because you may look back and say, well, because they went for two, maybe that meant a win that they wouldn't have otherwise gotten, perhaps. And that's, you know, sometimes in football we tend to get so wrapped up in the bottom line win and loss, you know, rather than really trying to analyze play to play, possession to possession, why things happen and what things really mean. So I think if people are looking at the Steelers win-loss ledger and they say, oh, they didn't advance at this point, it was a failure, I think they're missing the picture entirely. I mean, you could be the Jaguars and finish, say, 6-10. Let's say Gus Bradley decides to get on the go for two gospel and the Jaguars hit 54% of their 2-point conversions. Well, just because if they end up going 6-10 or 7-9 doesn't mean it wasn't a success.
Right. So moving on to the game here, coming into the season, this was supposed to be like a really big battle. The Lions had done pretty well last year, and they've got as many wide receiver weapons as the Broncos do with Calvin Johnson and Golden Tate. And this
and they complement each other as well as Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders do, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And so this was a matchup that had been identified as a huge one because obviously Sunday Night Football had seen it and they wanted it. And
it's the Lions' first home Sunday night game, I think, since NBC got the contract.
Yeah.
In 2006.
They did not luck out with how the Lions have been playing.
And well, it's early. They're only,
it's early.
And going on the road to San Diego and Minnesota, that's a tough way to start the year. Even tougher when the defense is in a state of transition without Ndamukong Suh, without Nick Fairley, DeAndre Levy's hurt. It's, you know, Ziggy Ansah's missed a practice this week. Clearly, it's a defense that it was in transition and now it's battling injuries as well. So
they're 0-2. They're 0-2, and coming home, they're going to be looking for a win. Desperate team, backs against the wall, and as I was looking up earlier, teams that are 0-2 do not generally go to the playoffs. Last year, Indianapolis went 0-2. Obviously, they went to the AFC Championship 2013. Carolina Panthers went 0-2. They went to the playoffs. But according to 538, the Nate Silver-led ESPN statistical site, teams that start 0-2 are something like 12%.
Yes.
It's definitely an uphill battle. And if you look at the other teams that are 0-2, and they're obviously not in contention with each other to get that statistical one playoff spot the last two teams.
But you figure Seattle's got the inside track.
Yep.
Another team that had to go on the road for a demanding couplet of games comes home and Seahawks get Cam Chancellor. Now, yes, there's nothing that says, that says, that maybe you won't see the statistical trend bucked, but at the same time you're looking at the teams that are 0-2 and you look at their divisions and you look at their quality and you look at the reasons why they're 0-2, you'd say the Lions are going to have a tough path ahead of them. Now, not only throwing out those other teams, but looking at what the Lions have to face in the NFC North, obviously Green Bay is still Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And losing last week at Minnesota, that was a big early game, and that's one that the Lions may look back on when the season is done and be a little bit frustrated about. Minnesota's a good team, but the Vikings were coming off just an awful performance in week one against San Francisco, and the Lions weren't able to contain Adrian Peterson and the Vikings ground game at all. So to bring that forward to week three and Broncos Lions, Detroit struggles against the run may bode well for the Broncos to finally get the running game on track after 2 weeks of nothing but frustration for them in that area of football.
And the Lions are also a team that have frustrations with their own rushing game offensively. They are league last in rushing attempts, period, which obviously wasn't helped by last week's game against the Vikings when they fell down early, had to kind of abandon the running game, even though Amir Abdullah has been pretty good for them so far.
And pretty good on kickoff returns as well, so they're going to find ways to get the ball in the hands of the rookie out of Nebraska. He's been explosive. But look, everything that the Lions accomplish on offense, it's going to stem from their passing game. Matthew Stafford's had a rib injury, but he's practiced this week.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to try to get the ball to Golden Tate and Calvin Johnson. You want to limit what they can do after the catch. It's going to be up to Aqib Talib and Chris Harris Jr. to do that. And this is why you make the investment in elite cornerbacks.
Right,
they're both Pro Bowlers.
They complement each other.
They complement each other. They're paid like Pro Bowlers, and you make the investment in this pair so you can free up your safeties and your linebackers to not have the same degree of responsibilities and coverage. They can then attack Matthew Stafford, maybe force some errant throws that Talib and Harris can intercept perhaps for the Broncos. So, the Broncos defense to me was built for a game like this.
Right.
and we'll see if how it holds up. I would like to think it could do very well, because I think the Broncos' defensive strengths match up well with the Lions.
And the Lions' current offensive weaknesses stem on offensive line. Mm-hmm. Broncos' pass rush can kind of compound the Lions' difficulties, the Lions' frustrations, if they get pressure on them.
Yeah, Stafford isn't getting sacked very often, but he is getting pressured. Mm-hmm. And that's led to some errant throws. And
Three picks.
I think you're going to see Wade Phillips try to dial up some pressure on Sunday, just as he did against the Ravens and the Chiefs. I think they're going to try to make Matthew Stafford uncomfortable. Now, granted, we know Stafford will stay in the pocket. We know he'll take the shots. That's, you know, he's a tough guy. I mean, he's mm-hmm. We were talking about this in the office. Wade Phillips alluded to it on Thursday afternoon. The 2-point conversion he completed after he separated his shoulder against Cleveland in 2009. So you know he'll stand in there and take the hits.
Touchdown.
Or was it a touchdown?
I think it was a touchdown, because I think they hit a field goal or a PAT to win the game.
Did Cleveland have the conversion? I thought there was a conversion involved in that game.
I think it was a touchdown.
It was a good game between two bad teams.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall, wasn't Brady Quinn starting for Cleveland that day? Didn't he have a big game?
I think so.
Yeah.
Either Ed Sable or Steve Sable, NFL Films, they called it. They had Stafford mic'd up.
Yeah.
Called it the best drama they've ever had. And watching it, it was like, I can see why. What a performance by him. I mean, he was a rookie. Just incredible. He separated his shoulder.
Stayed in.
Actually, because he was injured on the play before the touchdown.
They had to call timeout to keep him in,
the
right?
The Browns actually called the timeout.
Oh, okay.
And
you were obviously looking at the game book today.
Yeah, I took a look at it. I wanted to see it because I didn't remember any broken shoulder, but separated shoulder. Yeah. And they had actually pulled out the backup quarterback, and then the Browns took the timeout, and that allowed Stafford to come back in. And though you could tell he's kind of avoiding using that left shoulder.
Still made the play.
He made the play. Anyway, so tough guy, yes. He'll stand in the pocket, even when the pocket's collapsing. Mm-hmm. He'll take the hit if he has to. He can run if he has to, but he'd much rather get that pass off.
Yeah, and if they can get some shots early and some success on some shots and keep the crowd in it, certainly it's going to behoove them. I mean, it's their home opener. So we know that it's their home opener, and as we mentioned, first Sunday night game in many years at home. So we know that it's going to be a pretty electric atmosphere for the game. Jim Caldwell, the Colts head. I knew it. I knew I was going to make that mistake.
What?
The Lions head coach coached Manning within the Indianapolis Colts. You know, Caldwell knows Manning better than any other coach in this league.
Yes.
And knows his strengths and weaknesses. And certainly, you know, the Manning-Caldwell partnership in Indianapolis was responsible for some phenomenally successful seasons with Caldwell first as quarterback coach and then as Colts head coach. And now that being said, you know, Manning and Caldwell have gone up against each other.
Three times.
Well, this is the third time. That's right. Because it was the 2012 regular season.
Yeah.
Caldwell had just been promoted to offensive coordinator. And Manning's Broncos got the better of that one. Caldwell's Ravens got the better of the playoff game. And then Manning's Broncos won in week one of the 2013 regular season against Baltimore. So it's Manning 2, Caldwell 1 when they've gone head-to-head, although this is the first time that they've gone head-to-head with Caldwell running the entire show as he does in Detroit.
Yeah. He's talked about that impact, obviously, with Peyton Manning and the success he's had. Is going to have a lingering impact on your career if you're
just
been
a bit
with him. So, they go back a ways. One of the things I think about with this matchup, and I always think back to a John Fox press conference, and with Foxy, I think if you've seen one press conference, you've seen them all. to a degree. It's a game of matchups, as he would say pretty much every week.
And involving human talent?
Yes, always with human talent. And I just can't wait for this matchup between the Broncos cornerbacks and the Lions wide receivers, and I can't help but think that the way each position group's talent complements one another is reflected across the field.
Yeah. If Aqib Talib is on Calvin Johnson, now Talib doesn't have Johnson's size and reach. 6'5", 237, Johnson, my goodness. I mean, there's a, you know, he's an outstanding receiver, and he does all the little things right, but boy, he has a massive advantage in terms of size. Mm-hmm. A little bit less of an advantage than he's used to having against a bigger and physical cornerback like Talib, but then you have Harris on Golden Tate, and you know, that's just two guys who can, you know, who can work the underneath stuff very well. You know, they will. Well, I think frankly the biggest task for Chris Harris is to limit Golden Tate after the catch.
Right.
He's probably going to get his receptions, but
he loves to dance.
Right. But if Harris keeps him in front of him, doesn't miss any tackles,
mm-hmm.
and those 4 and 5 yard receptions don't become 10 to 15 yard gains, then even though Harris might end the day allowing 7 or 8 receptions, if he's limiting the yardage after the catch, he's had a successful day. And also, I'm sure he wants to keep that no touchdown streak alive too.
Man, how far that goes back? Oh, a long time now. I think that goes back to the 2013 season.
Yeah.
I think it was 2013 season. Yep. Offensively, the Broncos, I think you mentioned that we'll try and get the rushing game going. And hopefully, as head coach Gary Kubiak has alluded to this week, hopefully that'll have a two-found impact with pass protection as well. And then hopefully that'll tumble on forward, have a trickle-down effect, if mm-hmm. you will, on helping the passing attack do a little bit better too.
Yes, you hope that it creates better opportunities for Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders, because opponents have to be honest against the running game. You hope that it forces an opponent to bring a little less heat in the pass rush. I think that's the biggest thing you're looking for, a running game that takes the pressure, that forces an opposing defense to dial down the pressure, because we've seen the last two games, the Ravens and Chiefs at times have teed off on Peyton Manning, and he's mm-hmm. been sacked 7 times. He's been hit a few other times, and that's not sustainable. You know, that's you get nervous every time Peyton Manning gets hit, so they've got to do a better job in protection. But so much of that, I think, is going to come from getting the running game going, and that'll also get the play-action game going, which sets up some mm-hmm. the potential for shots downfield. One other thing the Broncos can do to help with all that, they've got to hit the deep shots when they're there, and they've just missed on several of them in the last two games. On one of those chances, when Emmanuel Sanders and Demaryius Thomas do get downfield against in one-on-one coverage, you know, the pass has to be accurate. They've got to bring it in, and they've got to make that play again to help keep the defense honest.
Thankfully, there isn't a Justin Houston or a Terrell Suggs or a Elvis Dumervil on the Lions, but it'll be worth keeping an eye on how that line stands up, especially in the middle. We've noted multiple times how the Broncos' failings in the pass protection has not so often been around the edges mm-hmm. as much as it's been coming up the A-gap.
Well, and you look at their 80-yard touchdown drive last week against Kansas City, and C.J. Anderson, he's in for every play, and he has a couple of key blitz pickups mm-hmm. on that series that kept Peyton Manning upright, and your running backs are going to have to be involved in that as well. And one reason why Anderson has still been valuable for the offense, even as he's battled the toe injury that's limited him in the running game, has been his pass protection. That's, you know, he and Peyton Manning are very much on the same page as far as, you know, as far as pre-snap adjustments, and also Anderson knowing what to do and where to block, and that's, you know, that's invaluable for the offense. It's invaluable for Peyton Manning. He's going to need to keep doing that. That being said, if the Lions do, you know, flood the box with pass rushers, if they do bring 6 or 7, you know, it's going to be just, someone's going to be free. It's just a question of who and whether Peyton Manning can get the ball away fast enough and avoid contact.
Well, it'll be a pretty interesting matchup. 0-2, 2-0. Those don't tell the stories of these two teams. But we'll be there in Detroit. It'll be fun. It'll be a rocking house.
And hopefully it goes better than the Broncos' last trip to Detroit way back in 2007. A 44-7 beatdown.
These teams don't face each other often, but...
The last two games have been really bad.
Yeah. Yeah, they have not been great.
Combined score, I believe, 89-17.
Ouch.
Including the 45-10 game at home. I'm sure y'all remember that. That was Tim Tebow's second start of the 2011 season. Did not go well at all. 45-10, and it really wasn't that close. Boy, it would be nice for the Broncos to have a much more competitive game at minimum than their last two against the Lions. The interesting thing about the 07 game, to go back to that for a moment, that pushed Detroit to 6-2. It was the age of Aquarius. Everything, you know, it was sunshine and lollipops, and you know, things were going well. The Lions looked like they were playoff bound, and they won one game the rest of that season. And then came 0-16. I mean that was the jump the shark moment. It was completely downhill from there.
Oof.
No, nowhere to go. And it only in 2011 did they finally recover to where they were on that day in 07. I think Jay Cutler got hurt. Patrick Ramsey had to see some time. Broncos were a mess that day. And if I recall correctly, one of the buses got lost. And after the game, I think it was like the staff and media bus, and got lost in Detroit. The sun is setting into the dark, into the stretches of urban prairie. And we're like, this is not the way to the airport. Oh, that was a little hair-raising. Hopefully the trip from Ford Field back to a Detroit Metro Airport goes a little more smoothly this time.
Oh, I hope so. Well, you'll be able to catch the game on NBC Sunday Night Football. That'll be 6:30 Mountain Time. And we'll have all your news and updates from Ford Field in Detroit. Thanks for listening. We'll catch y'all next week.